Monday night travel on Nightlife.
Tonight we're travelling back in time to hear about the misadventures of one of Spain's most unlucky explorers. Back in the 1500s, after making conquests in Mexico and Peru, the Spanish went in search of riches in what's now the United States. One of the first Spanish to explore the United States was Ponce de León. He'd been searching for the mythical Fountain of Youth in the Bahamas. Things haven't changed, really. When he ended up in 1513, spotting what's now Florida in the southern US. He claimed the land for Spain, but after spending a few years exploring the area, he was killed by local Indians in 1521. His explorations, however, laid the groundwork for a fellow Spanish conquistador, Panfilo de Narvaez, who was sent to Florida to colonize it. But things didn't quite go to plan on the journey. These were very tumultuous times. Ed Wright is the author of Lost Explorers, Adventurers Who Disappeared Off the Face of the Earth, which includes the story of Panfilo de Narvaez. Ed, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Oh, thank you, Philip.
It's a fascinating story, isn't it? He was born in 1478. He went on to become a Spanish conquistador. They were kind of noble men, weren't they? What was their main role?
A lot of them were impoverished noblemen. So there was that classic scenario where, you know, being an aristocrat meant that you couldn't actually work, and also perhaps, you know, they were younger sons or something like that, so they didn't inherit the estates. And the estates at that time, you know, there was a lot of economic trouble in Spain at that time. So there was a lot of excitement and a lot of opportunity for them to go out and try and, you know, become conquistador and travel to conquer the New World in order to gain immense riches for themselves and then be able to parlay that into status back in Spain, or alternatively, you know, set up their own versions of mini Spain in South and Central America.
Yeah, I mean, a bit like colonizers ever since. I mean, the British in India, of course, did exactly the same thing. Well, India served in exactly the same role for the British this did for Spain, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. What? Let's talk about him a bit more, though. He ended military service as a youth. He was one of the first settlers in Jamaica. So what? So he had no particular prospects in Spain, did he?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, obviously he'd gone off fairly early in entering military service. And, you know, I think, you know, in those days, you know, you'd give one son to the priesthood and another to the military, and the oldest one would take over the estate under primogeniture. That was the English system, and I'm not quite sure exactly whether that was the same in Spain, but I suspect something similar might have been happening.
Yeah. So he goes to Jamaica, and he commands a company of archers during Diego Velázquez's campaign to pacify Cuba. He's a success. He's rewarded, and he gets land grants on the island. But in March, he leaves Cuba and has a fleet of ships and about 900 men. And he has orders from Velázquez to capture and replace Cortés as ruler of Mexico. Now, what's gone on here? Because after all, the story of Cortés and the Aztecs is a legendary one, isn't it?
It is a legendary one, and Cortés was a pretty canny operator, as well as a brutal one. I think what probably happened there is there were jealousies between Velázquez and Cortés, and so Narvaez was sent there by Velázquez, who I think had the royal imprimatur over that territory, and he was... De Narvaez was sent to capture Cortés, and he had three times as many men as Cortés did when he arrived. But something about the quality of the man, as soon as he arrived there, a lot of his troops deserted and joined Cortés's side. And I suspect, you know, we talk about him being unfortunate, but I suspect a lot of his misfortune was self-generated. In terms of his capacity for the leadership of people and his, I suppose, pig-headedness in decision-making across his career. But, so with arriving with three times as many men, he was, overtaken by Cortés with a third of the men and put in jail for 2 years until he was eventually released.
He was released. He gets back and, but for some reason, the King of Spain in 1526 says, why don't you go and conquer and colonise Florida? What we now know as Florida anyway. He sets sail with five ships and 600 men. What happens then?
Well, yeah, I suppose he must have been one of those people. See, he was described as at one point as having a voice that sounded like it came out of a cave. And I suspect he might have had an imposing presence, but just not the kind of intellectual wherewithal to back it up when it came down to difficult decisions. So he'd obviously persuaded the King of Spain to give him this thing. And then he sent off, you know, he took off with a number of ships and troops to go and conquer Florida. But again, from the outset, it was a mission that was almost from the outset doomed by bad decision-making.
Things went wrong pretty straight up, didn't they? 140 men deserted, and then in Cuba, a hurricane sank two ships.
Yep.
How long did he stay in? Did he have to stay in Cuba before he could get set again for Florida?
It was quite a while, because I think they had to sort of, you know, they had to. Some ships got caught on reefs, and they had to wait for storms to blow them back off the reefs. And you know, another ship was ruined. It was quite some time, and I don't have the exact figures in my mind, but it was, you know, it was months at least.
Mm. Okay, eventually he gets to Tampa Bay in Florida.
Yeah.
What happens then?
Well, an argument, essentially. So some of his men believe that they should continue to sail up the bay in the ships, whereas Narvaez thinks that he's heard from the Indians that they talk to in Tampa Bay of a place called Appalachian, which is where there's a lot of gold, and that the Appalachian Indians in that place are, you know, possessed of considerable gold. And I think what happens there is that the Narvaez, you know, gets the sparkle of wealth in his eyes and determines, against the advice of most of his you know, other commanders, to take the expedition overland, leaving a skeleton crew on the ships to sail up the bay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so does he ever find this gold, this land of Appalachian where all this gold is? It's apparently near the present site of Tallahassee, is it?
Yeah, it's somewhere around there. And, I mean, obviously, you know, it's what we know now is the place called the Appalachians. This is obviously comes from those people in that village. So it's on the very southernmost point of what we might call the Appalachians in America, which we know today. He did find it, but he didn't find it. Well, when he got there, there was none of the riches that he might have imagined.
No, in fact, there was nothing much there but a town of clay huts, wasn't it? It was quite dangerous. I mean, they were regularly attacked by Indians before making it. They made it nearly 400 k's north, but then he decides to return to Cuba. But of course, he's overland. He doesn't have any ships, does he? Because they've all been given to the other half of the expedition who were sailing up the bay. So what does he do?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think about how these guys might have been operating, that they're suddenly in this vast, nonetheless populated wilderness, but they're really unable to tell whether the people they're trying to glean information from are hostile or friendly. Often they behaved appallingly to these people, and you know, the consequences of that, you know, affected on the kinds of information. You know, one suspects that the Indians were often telling them it's over there so they could just get rid of them and pass them on to the next people who may or may not have been their enemies. But what kind of happens there is he decides to go for the coast. And again, you know, if you think about the land, the Everglades in Florida, you know, it's famous for its swamps, its alligators, its snakes. You know, it's not easy. It's almost tropical. It's hot. There are mosquitoes, insects, diseases. And also there's just not the kind of food that these sort of arid land Europeans are used to finding. So, And it's hard for them to hunt in the forests. It's hard for them to see things in those kind of spaces. And so gradually, and at the same time, is very early on in the piece, the Indians realised that they couldn't probably directly confront the Spanish, you know, particularly probably because they had guns, but they also used dogs as a weapon and things like that. But what they did realise is that the Spanish were kind of cumbersome in their movement through the land and were easily, you know, easy pickings for guerrilla warfare. So as there was this constant sort of picking away at them, you know, from small attacks and running away and things like that. So just slowly, you know, the whole troop diminished. And eventually they came down to back to the sea again. But the boats weren't where they found them and everything like that. And so they had had another challenge as to what they were going to do.
So extraordinarily, they made their own. They made boats for themselves out of raw materials, pretty much.
Yeah, and I mean, oddly enough, this wasn't that uncommon in those days. And you know, that's one of the interesting things about trying to imagine the world of this kind of travel is that, you know, now when you get on an aeroplane, it's like getting on a bus or, you're on or off a cruise ship or something like that. These people were travelling through places that they didn't know. And when they came across challenges, then they often had to construct their own means of transportation, which is pretty amazing. Unfortunately, in this case, they'd left all their tools and everything like that on the ships. And so they didn't have access to any of the equipment that they might have otherwise used to do it. And secondly, there was only, I think, one carpenter amongst the crew or the bunch of people they were still with.
Still, they managed to cobble together some boats by using iron from their stirrups and crossbows. They made that into nails. They used shirts for sails and covered the boats with horse hide to try and waterproof them. Anyway, they set sail. Off they go across the Gulf of Mexico. As they pass the mouth of the Mississippi River, there's another storm. And the boat commanded by Narvaez remains afloat. But then, while the boat was anchored that night, a strong north wind sweeps him and two others who'd remained aboard out to sea. And they were never heard from again.
Well, yeah, one of them was destroyed. I think there were four, and I don't think it was described by Cabeza de Vaca, whose account remains to us of this expedition, that they were barges essentially, about 30-foot long barges, which is quite a long barge, but not the sort of thing that's particularly seaworthy. And, you know, we all know that the Gulf of Mexico has a, you know, propensity for hurricanes and big storms and things like that. And then obviously they hit one. And then there's this moment in Cabeza de Vaca, which is probably the last time any living person saw the barge on which de Narvaez was on. And it's just saying, he asked, you know, de Narvaez had taken all the best men for himself to row his barge. And the barge that Cabeza de Vaca was coming behind him. And he asked de Narvaez whether he could get somebody to throw them a rope so they could stay together. And de Narvaez said, no, well, that would slow me down. And at this stage, it's inappropriate for anyone to issue a command to anybody else. And basically it's all men for themselves. And so he rowed off with his superior crew, but rowed off obviously into the face of the storm and destruction and was never seen again.
And and Alvar Cabeza de Vaca begins an 8-year journey. He travels all the way across the southwest United States and then down into Mexico and reaches Mexico City in 1536. That must have been quite a trip.
That is an astonishing voyage. And it's one of, you know, involves being held as a slave, and, you know, escaping from slavery and, you know, traveling across. And there were, I think, from memory, and then eventually he meets up with two or three people from one of the other barges, and together there are four of them, of the 500 or so people who make it back to Mexico. And, I mean, that's just an amazing trip, how they ever did that. I mean, it's brilliant.
But our hero, Mr. Nave, is, of course, is somewhere at the bottom of the drink, it seems.
Yes.
It's a fascinating story. Ed, thank you for telling it.
No worries, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.